good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding in the dark.
You're listening to episode 522 of Unwelcome Guests. Spiritual and social separation. I'm Robin Upton. I nearly subtitled this show The War on Childhood because a considerable part of it is about why and how people have set about making illegal and making socially unacceptable what it means to be a child. But it's not only about children, and I thought it would be more descriptive to subtitle this The Left Hand of God and Nature Deficit Disorder. In reverse order, our second hour, we're going to hear from Richard Louvre, who coined the phrase Nature Deficit Disorder, about the disconnection that people feel from the natural environment and possible causes and possible solutions. And we're also going to hear from another child educator about her experiences interviewing children about their secret places and her testimony that it was very important for the children to have a place of their own. I hear echoes of John Taylor Gatto there. In the first hour, we're going to hear from Rabbi Michael Lerner, an academic, activist, and self-styled spiritual progressive. He founded the Network of Spiritual Progressives in 2005, largely based on the ideas that he's going to be talking about tonight. The ideas that corporations and big money has cut people off socially and sold back that reconnection to each other. And he doesn't make this parallel clear, but it fits very much with what George Lakoff said about the strict father and the nurturing parent. The strict father being the mindset that says, I know what's what, and it is my duty to punish my children and to punish anybody who disagrees with me sufficiently painfully or sufficiently threateningly that they learn what is right and embrace my values. So that's the strict father, and the nurturing parent says security is not from having lots of guns but having lots of friends, and it's my duty as a parent to relate positively to my children, to model empathy, and thus to lead them into a state of positive connections with the world. And Rabbi Lerner says this dichotomy is in every religion, and he includes Marxism and psychoanalysis in his list of religions. He says this is an unaddressed or largely misunderstood dichotomy by what he calls the political left, and he'll go on to explain how this has served the purposes of the religious right. Sandwiched in between these two, I've just squeezed in a few minutes with Bill McKibben to reveal how mainstream this kind of dialogue is becoming, which I find very encouraging. Thanks to Jeff Cheshire for sending me this, because he thought it might suit. Very much did. This is from 2006, Michael Lerner being interviewed by Mary Charlotte Demandy.
I'd like to welcome now, by telephone, Rabbi Michael Lerner. He's the editor of Tikkun magazine. He's the author of this new book, The Left Hand of God, Taking Back Our Country from the Religious Right. And he will be here in Santa Fe this weekend at the Armory for the Arts. It's on Saturday night, April 1st at 7:30. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Hi.
It's great to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Now, you begin your book with a vivid description of the spiritual malaise that is going on in this country and that's been going on for some time, in which you quote from many interviews with people from all walks of life. What was the common thread that you saw in these interviews?
Well, the common thread was that there's a deep spiritual crisis in people's lives, and that it is rooted in, number one, the deprivation of the desire for meaning and purpose in the world of work. And people are deprived of the capacity to use their time in a way that connects to some higher meaning and purpose. Now, this is astounding to us because we didn't realize, coming from a kind of academic or intellectual or progressive background, we always sort of had this prejudice that we were on a higher level and that most working people were as just concerned about money. And summed up by James Carville, who said, it's the economy, stupid. But what we were learning from people was that there was a hunger for something much more than that, that people really felt deprived of a capacity to use their life to connect to higher meaning and purpose. So that was one level of a spiritual crisis, that people felt like their lives were being wasted all day in the world of work because the bottom line was money and power, and they were learning day after day that if they did not spend all of their time and energy maximizing money and power for their corporation or for wherever they were working, they were going to get downsized out of a job. But then on the other hand, the other thing they were learning at the world of work is just to look at other people from the framework of what can you be of use to me, and internalizing a consciousness about other people basically says, I have to look out for number one. Nobody else is going to take care of me. So it's a kind of utilitarian framework in which you see other people through the frame of what can you do for me. But then people bring that home into personal life, and they feel surrounded by other people who have learned the rationality of the marketplace in which everybody is looking out for number one. And as a result of that, relationships start to become much weaker. People feel they're surrounded by people who only care about themselves, and they feel misrecognized. Nobody really sees who they are. Instead, they are only seen through the framework of what can this person do for this other person? In other words, nobody sees who I really am, is what people were telling me. They're saying, even my kids only look at me from the standpoint of what I can do for them. Even my spouse looks at me from the standpoint of what can I do for her or for him. So people are feeling increasingly lonely, even in their marriages, even in their family life, and scared that even those relationships may quickly collapse, because in a society in which everybody is looking out for number one, you have very little certainty that your own spouse won't at some point find somebody who they think could satisfy more of their needs than you can, and then because they're a rational maximizer of self-interest that is looking out for number one, they're going to leave you and go to this next person. So there's a tremendous amount of fear and upset about living in a society where there's so much selfishness and materialism, and this is central to what led many of these people to become attracted to the religious right.
There's a poignant passage among the interviews that you quote, a woman saying, I remember I was a lively little girl once, and I'm dead inside now. You write about how the religious and political right really recognized this spiritual hunger and spoke powerfully to the many people who were searching for meaning. What did they offer that progressive religion and progressive politics did not offer?
Well, first of all, they offered an aliveness. That is, if you compare some of the services that the religious right offers to some of the services, to many of the services that you find in establishment churches, there's just more energy, there's more aliveness, there's more dance and music and upbeat energy. So that's one level. It's sort of the only place you find that in the non-religious right, really, with any sustained energy, is in the African-American churches.
Right.
But particularly the Baptist churches. So that's one level. But the second level is that there's a kind of focus on community and building community that is very, very accepting and loving. This is the irony, because those of us who are liberals or progressives often think focus on how negative the religious right is towards those outside the community. And I think that's a correct perception. But what we forget is that inside the community, people really do a lot of taking care of each other. I've had this experience throughout my life, and people were telling me the same thing. And I had that experience in the religious world, in which the Jewish religious world, in which I'd go to a Reform or a Conservative or a Reconstructionist or a Jewish Renewal synagogue, and people had great lines to put forward in terms of when you'd hear the sermon, it was terrific. It was liberal, it was progressive, it had wonderful ideas. But afterwards, everybody went home. There was no real, nobody really reached out. On the other hand, you go to an Orthodox synagogue and you hear, from my standpoint, I heard things that I couldn't stand from the sermon and that felt to me to be reactionary or racist. But then, after the service, people reached out and asked, do you have a place to go to lunch? Is there somebody in your family who needs to have a visit? Would you like to meet somebody of the opposite sex so we can fix you up? Or this kind of thing, which seems trivial, but actually makes people feel that somebody cares about them, not just about whether they have the right idea, but whether they themselves personally are being cared for. Go to a left meeting and you hear any progressive cause. You go to a meeting and it's terrific in terms of what's being said, but very little follow-through in terms of actually being a caring community. And these religious right communities actually are very often caring communities. So that provides a deep alternative for people who feel that they are alone and that nobody really cares about them. And then also there isn't this, you know, in the politics of the right, there isn't this emphasis on equal opportunity, because equal opportunity, on the one hand, I'm totally for it, because I want to make sure that those people who have been left out of American society get an equal chance. But for many other people, what they hear when they hear equal opportunity is, you get the equal opportunity to compete in the competitive marketplace. And a lot of people don't think they're going to do so well in that marketplace and feel like nobody's really, you know, that it's not such a great offer to have an equal opportunity to compete. They'd much more like to hear about love and caring and kindness and generosity, which are things that the left rarely talks about. You rarely hear anybody in the liberal or progressive world get up and say, love is what we are after. Well, you go to the religious right and they're unafraid to talk about love and caring and generosity, and that's a very big thing for people who aren't thinking, oh yeah, if I just get better opportunities in the marketplace, I'm going to make it. Very often people hear from the left a kind of economistic worldview in which what the focus is, we're going to make sure that everybody has equal opportunity to compete, we're going to make sure that everybody has equal rights, we're going to do our best to redistribute money in a fair way. Well, those things are very important, and I support them 100%. But for many, many people, the problem in their life is not that they don't have enough opportunity to make it in the marketplace. The problem in their life is they don't have enough love. They don't have enough caring. They don't have enough generosity. They don't have enough meaning in their life. And these issues are almost never addressed by the left.
And they were in the 60s. I mean, Love Is All You Need was one of the many theme songs that had to do with that, and that was the birth of the leftist movement.
Yes, exactly. And there was a deeper integration of spiritual and political issues in the 60s, and particularly at the time when the left was led, when the left was most popular, was when the left was led by Martin Luther King Jr.
Right.
And when the African-American church was playing this central role, and every one of his demonstrations began in a church, and they would march from the church service onto the streets. And there was this integration of spiritual and political in which people, but unfortunately, after he was killed, the left became dominated by a different kind of voice that was much more, let's say, white. The white leadership of the left was and is very alienated from, estranged from, and unsympathetic to religious and spiritual life.
We're talking to Rabbi Michael Lerner. His book is called The Left Hand of God, Taking Back Our Country from the Religious Right. And it is available, ladies and gentlemen, to anybody who calls right now, 428-1393, and makes a pledge to KSFR of $75 or more. So please call and support public radio and get a copy of this marvelous book. Rabbi Lerner will be here this coming Saturday night, April 1st, at 7:30 at the Armory for the Arts. You talk, Rabbi Lerner, about this term, the left hand of God. What are the left hands and the right hands? What do God's two hands do?
Well, actually, what I'm referring to here is, first of all, that there are two worldviews that have been in human consciousness for at least the last several thousand years. One of them says human beings are fundamentally alone. We're thrown into a world in which there's this competition and ruthless struggle for survival, and we need to dominate and control other people in order to protect ourselves. In order to achieve any kind of security, we have to recognize that other people will attempt to dominate or control us unless we succeed in dominating and controlling them first.
And that's what you call cynical realism.
Cynical realism and the right hand of God. Now, why do I call it the right hand of God? Well, because in the Bible, after the Israelite children are freed from slavery in Egypt, they sing a song to God, and that song, led by Miriam, and says the following: "Your right hand, God, your right hand is filled with power." So the other worldview is the worldview that says that actually we're not thrown into this world all by ourselves. We come into the world in relationship to a mother, and we would never survive without this mothering other who gives this love for the first few years when we could not possibly survive as an infant without that self-sacrificing love that is in which there's no reasonable expectation of a good return on her investment of time and energy. And that provides us with an understanding that the world could be based on love and caring and generosity, and that security and can come from building loving relationships and connections to other people rather than through domination of other people. So that's the view that then is articulated also in the Bible with the phrase also in Exodus, the Lord, full of mercy and compassion, loving kindness and generosity, showing mercy to the 10,000th generation. That's the left hand of God. So what I'm saying in this book is that the right hand of God, that is the view of the world through power, has gotten out of joint with the left hand of God, and that we need to rebalance them so that... Now, why do I say talk about God in this way? Well, human beings are the people who receive whatever message we receive from the universe about the nature of reality. And we have both of these worldviews in our head. And so sometimes we're hearing the voice of God from a standpoint of a right hand and sometimes from a left hand. But by the way, this is not just a religious issue, because if you look at the sacred texts of any religion, for example, Marxism, for example, psychoanalysis, for example, feminism, you'll always hear both voices in their holy texts, namely the voice of those who think that really whatever the goal is, that can only be achieved by domination and power over the evil other, and those who think, no, the real way to achieve the kind of world we want to see is through love and kindness and generosity. So both voices are there in every human enterprise, and in religion, they've gotten out of joint not just in religion, actually in the whole society. It's gotten out of joint in the past many years, in which we find people thinking through the framework of the right hand of God, looking at the reality through that framework and thinking, yes, we are in a period in which we need domination, and forget this love business. It's silly, it's naive, it's adolescent, it's utopian. All of those dismissive ways of understanding this other voice. And so part of my argument in this book is to rebalance these two things. But another part of it is also to say that even when you recognize that there is this right hand of God voice in the Bible, in other words, it's also there, it's not that the right made that up, but what has happened with the religious right is that they've inverted the meaning of it, because when God is seen through the framework of power and domination in the Bible, whether that's the Hebrew Bible or whether that's the New Testament, in both places, God is invoked as the source of power when the people are faced with an empire that they can't imagine how they could possibly defeat, just as today we're faced with global capital and its incredible power around the world. In those times, there was first the Jews facing the Israelites facing the Egyptian Empire, which was the most powerful that had ever been, and then Jesus and his fellow Jews facing the Empire of Rome. And in that case, what the Bible does is say, okay, well, you're not alone. There's this God in the universe. There's this force in the universe that will make it possible to overcome the powerful so that the powerless will not be stuck in their powerlessness. But what the religious right has done today is it has taken that vision of God and handed it over to the most powerful elites that have ever existed in the history of humanity. And so they then get to use God to justify cutting social programs for the poor and cutting their own taxes to reduce their tax burden so that they have a lot more money, and justifying through their relationship with this God of power their right to dominate people around the world. In other words, a total inversion of what the biblical vision of God was. Instead of it being a force to empower the powerless to fight the powerful, this is now being used by the religious right as a God that empowers the powerful to dominate the powerless. A complete inversion of what the Bible was about.
We're talking to Rabbi Michael Lerner. His book is called The Left Hand of God, Taking Back Our Country from the Religious Right. It's, I mean, the irony that you just pointed out a moment ago, on the one hand, you've got this spiritual meaningless, which is caused by unfettered capitalism, and then the very people who are criticizing this are wholeheartedly supporting unfettered capitalism. Is this contradiction lost on not so much the dominators, but the common people who are embracing the religious and political right?
Well, it is lost because there's nobody there to point it out. You see, the contradiction that you mentioned, which is one of the central points of this book, that here is the right championing the ethos of selfishness and materialism in the world, in the economy, always fighting against any attempt by liberal or progressive forces to introduce categories of social responsibility in the world of work, whether that's in terms of a living wage for workers, or whether that's in the form of environmental safety regulations, or whether that's in the form of safety and health regulations at the workplace, or whether that's in the form of insisting that what's being produced is safe for the consumer. It's always the right that is fighting against government and saying we need to downsize government and allow the corporations to be free to pursue their own self-interest without any constraints. And then the best good will be served for all, because the more money that the corporations were allowed to accumulate for themselves, the more it will trickle down to the rest of the population. This is their worldview. And so here they are championing the notion of selfishness and materialism in the world of work, opposed to every attempt to introduce any moral categories or social responsibility there, and then positioning themselves as the articulator of the pain that people feel in personal lives, and saying, isn't it terrible that there's so much selfishness and materialism in the world and in our daily lives and undermining families, when they're the very force that's championing that thing in the world of work? So how do they get away with it? They get away with it because the left, the liberal and progressive forces in our society, aren't even in the relevant ballpark. They don't even notice that there's a spiritual crisis for people, and all they focus on is economic entitlements and political rights. Again, I want to say that the economic entitlements and political rights that the left struggles for are very important, and I totally support them. No spiritual program can turn its back on the poor. No spiritual program can shut its eyes when people are homeless. No spiritual program can ignore the inequality of rights in the society. So I'm totally with the left, but the left isn't winning. It can't win because there are so many people whose real pain in their life is not only economic or deprivation of political rights, but in the spiritual crisis. And the left doesn't get that there is a spiritual crisis, so it's in no position to say, and it doesn't say, you know what, the spiritual crisis is correct, but the right has the wrong diagnosis of it, because they end up blaming the spiritual crisis on feminists, on gays and lesbians, on liberals, on secular people. They have the wrong diagnosis of it. You can't say that the right has the wrong diagnosis of it if you don't believe there is in it. And that's the problem with the left. They don't get that there's a real spiritual crisis in people's lives. So they've let the right, they've given over to the right the entire sphere of spirituality. And once you do that, then there's nobody there to call attention to the contradictions of the right's vision of what's wrong in the society.
In your book, you paint a picture in which progressive movements have failed in the ways that you're describing, and they need revitalization. And at the same time, if you listen to the alternative media, it becomes clear that a Democrat actually did win the presidential election in 2000, and that vote manipulation and blatant lying and bribery and dirty tricks and just cynical corruption are central to the current government. Do you think it's possible, at least to some extent, the progressive movements have been duped into thinking that they failed when actually they've been simply cheated?
Well, you know, here we have to acknowledge that, yes, there's a lot of cheating. There's no question about that. And I wouldn't be certainly. It seems to me that we ought to try to get a replacement of the Electoral College, which is extremely undemocratic. And certainly, there's lots of evidence that what happened in Ohio in this last election looked like a cheat for the Democrats. But it's a big mistake to equate Democrats with progressive. You just said, have they won? No. The candidates that were put forward by the Democrats, let's take Kerry, hardly a progressive. He was running on a campaign to increase the amount of troops in Iraq. He was arguing that the way to deal with homeland security is to track down every single terrorist on the planet and kill them. This is a progressive agenda. In other words, the Democrats might have won, but the Democrats have continually repositioned themselves further and further and further to the right, more and more and more clones of, or let's say, Republicans light. So I don't think that those elections would be a good evidence for the fact that the progressive forces are winning and just having their victories stolen from them. I think that the Democrats have no vision, no unifying vision that can speak to the American public, and certainly no unifying progressive vision. So I don't think that the evidence would lead us to think that the progressive forces are already winning. On the other hand, it is true that on many specific issues, the American public is more on the side of a progressive view than they are on the side of a conservative view. And then you have to ask, well, then how come they don't win elections? But there, it's not because the elections are stolen. And in the book, The Left Hand of God, I interview many people who say, yeah, I agree with the left on the war or on social justice or on ecological issues, but I feel like I can't be part of it. I feel like I'm looked down upon so much. I'm made to feel like I'm less than in the left. And there's this deep elitism that permeates left culture, that particularly in regard to religion, that makes people who are religious or spiritual feel one down, feel that they are that the dominant secular voice in the left reflects a vision that says that anybody who has a spiritual consciousness or a religious consciousness is probably on a lower level of intellectual or psychological development. And that, yes, we might need your votes, so please come on in, but leave your spiritual or religious garbage at the door, because we don't want to hear that stuff, and it really doesn't have anything to contribute to the rest of us. And basically, don't let us know about that stuff in your life. So there are plenty of people on the left who are spiritual or religious, but they keep it to themselves. I had a very interesting conversation with somebody at a reading I was doing for this book in Seattle last week. A young woman said that there was a guy she was interested in, and he called her and asked her to go for a walk on Sunday morning, and she said, no, I'm going to church Sunday morning. And he sounded shocked and said, but I thought you were a Democrat.
Oh, my Lord.
And it was, I mean, it wasn't, and many people in the crowd nodded their heads. Yes, we've had that experience too. Not that specific one, but what it reflects, which is the sense that if you're into religion or spirituality, you're suspect of being a reactionary.
We're talking to Michael Lerner. His book is called The Left Hand of God, Taking Back Our Country from the Religious Right. One thing that's scary about this whole right political movement and religious movement is that certain factions of the religious right, certain large voting factions, believe in Armageddon, that we're at an end time, that we're waiting for the second coming of Jesus Christ. What do you think are the political implications of this belief? You write about this in your book.
Yeah. Well, on the one hand, let me say that they're partly right. That is to say, they have an intuition that is not totally distorted, because if we don't change the social system that we're in, we're faced with a global ecological crisis of Armageddon-like proportions within the next 50 to 100 years. I don't know if you saw this week's Time magazine, the cover of it, but it says,
yeah, that's right.
You know, it's time to start worrying, really worrying. You know, if you're really you're not being paranoid if you think that we're on the end of time. But, of course, the religious right doesn't understand why we're at the end of time. It has something to do with the politics that their champions, like the Bush administration, have been following. So they've got an intuition that there's a disaster happening. Many of the rest of us who sort of know it don't let that into our consciousness. We sort of know that, if we continue in the direction we're going, the planet is going to be destroyed. But we don't really let it into our feeling level. They, on the right, let it into their feeling level that the planet is on the verge of destruction.
Well,
only they have the totally wrong analysis of it. They think that Jesus is going to come back and do this destruction and rectify all the rights. Well, that's not going. That is not what we in the progressive world want to say. But and in adopting that kind of a worldview, they then say, well, it doesn't really matter what politics we follow right now. Politics is irrelevant. The only thing that really counts is for everybody to adopt our religious position. And the only way that they can be saved individually is to adopt our religion. And then that gives them the motivation to say, well, then we need to impress religion on people, even if they don't want it, or try to push it onto them, because that's the way we can save them. And that will be the most loving act we can do, is to get these people around us to adopt our religion.
I mean, I have to say, reading your book, and especially reading that first part where you so eloquently described how depressed people were about the system in which they lived, I began to think that they were sort of looking forward to Armageddon, because within this system there was just no way out, so let's all die and have it all destroyed. It was like there's a kind of death wish in it or something.
Well, you know, it's a depression. People are deeply depressed in this society, and not everybody, and of course what I say here, everything that I've been saying has to be qualified in many, many ways, and I do a lot more qualification and nuancing of this in the book than I'm doing right now in the radio show, but there's a huge depression for many, many people in this society. They can't see how their life is connected to anything that they really believe in. They can't see where goodness is coming from. They're continually bombarded by messages of fear. They're surrounded by terrorists, they believe, who are about to destroy their lives. And they see their children faced with sexual pressure when they're now at 10 and 11 and 12 years old, young girls being forced by the culture to dress in sexually provocative ways and drugs at 11 and 12 and so forth. It's very scary to a lot of people, and it's very hard for them to see how any of this is going to change. So, yes, in that depression, many people embrace the possibility of a whole new world. Well, I'm for that. I want people to embrace the possibility of a whole new world, but the way to get that is through building a transformative politics. Unfortunately, they think that they can't see how a transformative politics is possible. They believe that the real world is stuck in its evil ways. That is, they don't get that they are actually reinforcing that by supporting political forces that have created the very world that they hate. And so instead, they embrace religious worldviews that are that say, oh, the world is going to be destroyed. And that's their way of healing themselves from the pain that they feel in their daily life, by looking forward to a destruction of this world and a validation of a different kind of world fundamentally. So there's, again, you always have to see what's good in that. What's good in that is that they recognize that there's something really screwed up in the world that we have. What's bad in that is that they hear nobody providing them with a plausible scenario for how that could change, and so they embrace these Armageddon-like total destruction visions of what can happen, and abandon politics rather than embrace a progressive spiritual politics of the sort that I try to articulate in The Left Hand of God.
You write a section in your book that I found fascinating, which was about the fact that Bill Clinton, when he was still governor of Arkansas, was reading Tikkun. He was reading your editorials, and he wrote to you. He used some of your ideas in his speeches and then really used them to shape the vision that he communicated in his campaigns. Tell us about that, and then what happened to that vision when he became president of the United States?
Well, when he became president of the United States, he lost. He became realistic. It's so funny that he took those ideas and used them when he was running for office, and he told me he was going to. I didn't really believe it until I started hearing his speeches. He was quoting directly from my editorials in Tikkun, and then he, when he got to be president, he's surrounded by all these advisors who are telling him, "Look, you're no longer a country bumpkin from Arkansas. You're the president of the United States, and you've got to deal with the realities here." And his own Democratic Party was filled with congressional leaders who didn't want to move in any serious way to change any status quo. And they failed to back, when he had the Democrats were a majority in the Congress, they failed to back his health care plan. But his health care plan itself was a monstrosity that had been created to appease all of the money-oriented people. Now, I was talking to them about it, and what they were saying to me was, "Well, but we have to be realistic." And I was saying, "Yeah, but there's a desire. The thing that got you elected was this desire to have a different kind of reality, and you were saying that when you were on the campaign trail. And you need to stand with the ideals that you hold." And they said, "Yeah, but there's no movement out there. There's nobody out there. We don't hear the voices of anybody who is saying that they want a different kind of world. All we're hearing are the pragmatists telling us to compromise with the existing power structures." And I said back, "But yeah, but you're the president."
Right.
"To provide the leadership." And they said, "It won't work. There's nobody out there." And so I learned from this experience that it was that if you want to change the people in power, I had the I had the access, I had the ears of the, but it didn't matter. What mattered to them was that there be a force in the world that they could look to and say to their advisors, "Look, there's this social movement that's forcing us to move in this direction, and we're responding to that social movement." And actually, the most significant changes that have happened in the 20th and 21st century happen in response to those social movements. It's the social movement of the women's movement and of gay and lesbian movement and the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement in the the last part of the 20th century that shaped and pushed realities far more than any particular political leader. People are always asking me, "Who is the political leader who's going to back your ideas?" Well, there are a lot of people who whisper in my ears saying, "Rabbi Lerner, I really agree with what you're saying in this book, and I really think that you're on the right path here." But they won't go out publicly to say it because they're scared that there's no movement there. So if you want to influence, you have to build something from below. That's below. We're creating. The book isn't just a book. It's creating a new national organization called the Network of Spiritual Progressives. And by the way, that's not just for religious people, but also for people who don't believe in God, who don't believe in any kind of higher authority, but who do believe that there is a spiritual dimension to human reality that is fundamental to human needs. So we're building an alliance between spiritual people who are not religious and progressive religious people to put forward a whole new politics in this country that we call progressive spiritual politics. And so this network of spiritual progressives that we're building, your readers can find online at spiritualprogressives.org.
Spiritualprogressives.org. I mean, this is the whole thing, right? That Democrats really need to stop being realistic, quote unquote, and turn to this visionary hopefulness as they had in the New Deal, and you talk about what you call the spiritual covenant with America.
Right.
What would this look like, and is anybody already doing it?
Well, actually, nobody is doing it. In other words, there's the best that is happening is that on some segments of the left, you get an attempt to shape a program, a progressive program, but it doesn't have any unifying idea. It's like 77 different good points. It doesn't have something that brings all those points together. It sort of tries to be a coalition of everything. And I'm not against that. It's just that it doesn't have a vision of a positive vision of what the world could be. So we're saying the central vision of the Network of Spiritual Progressives, and by the way, it's co-chaired by Cornel West, the African-American professor of African-American studies and religious studies at Princeton, and by Sister Joan Chittister, who is a Benedictine sister and one of the most famous feminists in the religious world. And what we're calling for, what we're saying is that America needs a new bottom line. The old bottom line is money and power. What we're saying is institutions should be judged efficient, rational, and productive, not only to the extent that they maximize money and power, but also to the extent that they maximize love and caring, kindness and generosity, ethical and ecological sensitivity, enhance our capacities to respond to other human beings as embodiments of the sacred, and enhance our capacities to respond to the universe with awe and wonder and radical amazement at the grandeur of creation. Now, you put that forward as your new criterion of rationality, productivity, and efficiency, and you'll quickly see that most American institutions are inefficient, irrational, and unproductive. That is, they don't tend to produce loving and caring people. They don't tend to produce ethically and ecologically sensitive people. They don't tend to produce awe and wonder at the universe or an ability to recognize others as embodiments of the sacred. So it's not that there aren't lots of loving and caring people in the society. They are, but there are. But they are that despite the institutions in which we spend our lives, not because of them. And so we're seeking a fundamental change. Actually, sometimes people think, oh, well, the spirituality thing is a side thing. But no, the kind of spiritual transformation that we're talking about is actually far more radical, that is far more getting to the roots of what's wrong. Because what we're saying is, let's look at a whole new vision of what really counts. And when you make decisions, what is it that really counts? And we're saying, make what really counts maximizing love and caring and generosity. Now, of course, that seems cuckoo to a lot of people. They think, well, that's too utopian. It'll never happen in the world. But actually, when you start to talk in that kind of language, you transcend the old left-right barrier. You stop thinking in left-right terms, and you start thinking in terms that could build a political force that brings together many people on the right with many people on the left, and yet it has radical implications. For example, first implication in this 8-point spiritual covenant that we are going to be bringing to Congress May 17th to May 20th, Washington, D.C., when we're having our first national conference in Washington, D.C., there's a program, eight-point program, but the fundamental core of it is this. We have to recognize the unity of all being, the interconnectedness of all with all, which means that instead of just looking out for America, or another way of putting this is, instead of thinking that America can have a solution for itself, we start from the understanding that all people are interconnected and that the well-being of America depends on the well-being of every other person on this planet. And so so there's no solution for America without a solution that takes care of everyone else. So what's our plan for homeland security? We're saying that we need a global Marshall Plan for homeland security in which for the next 20 years, each of the next 20 years, 5% of the gross domestic product of the United States should be dedicated to ending global poverty, homelessness, hunger, inadequate education, inadequate health care, and repairing the environment. Now, if you do use our money in that way, instead of spending trillions of dollars each year on a military that doesn't actually provide homeland security, reduce the military to bring it back to our borders, defend our borders, protect our borders, search every container that comes into the country, but use the rest of these trillions of dollars to end global poverty, and you will get far more homeland security than you're going to get by any of the means that are currently being suggested by either Republicans or by Democrats. In other words, this is a whole different vision that's a spiritual vision that recognizes the unity of all being and hence the interconnectedness of all with all and the oneness of us with everyone else, that spiritual vision leads us to recognize that we need to take care of the other people on the planet because their well-being and our well-being are intrinsically interconnected.
Now, I wish a very hearty amen to that last comment. Now, if you've checked out my website, you'll probably know I've been working for 5 years on a system of economics which explicitly declares people's reliance on one another and values relationships with other people. Now, I've wondered whether calling that altruistic economics was a mistake, because there's two sorts of people, those who've studied economics and those who haven't, and often, this is my interpretation, people who've studied economics think in a certain way. Research has shown that it does increase your propensity to be self-interested, a homo economicus, a selfish maximizer. So economists look at it and say, well, this is rubbish because it doesn't make logical sense to them. And I think too many non-economists see the word economics and think, whoa, I don't want any of that, because that used to be my reaction. I'll leave altruistic economics for another show. I could talk all night about that, but I won't. But, right, it's a point that is also picked up by Bill McKibben, who was described by Time magazine as the world's best green journalist. I don't know who the Boston Globe are, but they call him probably the nation's leading environmentalist. So, not a fringe figure, and he too is arguing for a pretty radical change to the bottom line. So profitability should not just be in terms of money. Now, I would go further and say having it in terms of money at all is inviting control from the small elite who run the show. But of course, if he were to go that far, he wouldn't be cited by the mainstream figures. Anyway, my point is that it is an interesting interview. It's 52 minutes long, and I'm just giving you a 5-minute snippet of this because this is the most relevant, and I wanted to leave some time to re-listen to Charles Eisenstein, who's offering us a larger framework on why society is being disconnected and why it seems to be coming apart at the seams. So now here is Bill McKibben speaking from 2007.
Economists are beginning, at least some of them, to study these deeper questions about whether our current model, more is better, actually works not only ecologically, but works for human happiness, for human satisfaction. And the data is pretty convincing that it doesn't.
Yeah, I want to get into that data with you because I think it's important that listeners hear. But it's also, some would say, bucking against the tide here because of growth and globalization being so intrinsic and so integral to not only this nation's paradigm for itself, but to the developing nations, to India, to China, as well as nations that are trying to struggle out of their poverty.
There's no question that it's bucking against what we consider politically realistic at the moment. I mean, what did Bill Clinton say? It's the economy, stupid. You know, I mean, it's pretty much what we do. On the other hand, you know, our civilization is now bucking against fundamental laws of physics and chemistry. And we're beginning to see that with temperatures rising quickly and much that will follow in their wake. And, you know, intractable as our kind of political and economic decisions seem, they're a lot more tractable than the laws of physics and chemistry before which ultimately we're going to bend. And it's also true that they may be, you know, more tractable than the laws of human nature, which our economy seems not to be satisfying in some of the ways we would have thought it did.
Talking to Bill McKibben, his new book is Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future. Not more, but better. That's kind of the anthem here, isn't it?
You know, here's an interesting piece of data. Every year since the end of World War II, pollsters have asked Americans, are you happy? Which, as I've said to someone once, must be a kind of disconcerting question to get before dinner over the telephone, you know, from some pollster. But the number of Americans who say that they're very happy peaks in 1956 and goes pretty steadily downhill since. About a quarter of Americans will make that claim today. In the same 50 years, the average standard of living for Americans, our material prosperity, has almost trebled. Now, if the things that we kind of intuitively believe about the economy were true, those two curves should track in more or less the same direction. They shouldn't split fundamentally apart the way that they are. And
unless we were asleep in the 50s and awakened in the 60s with liberation and all that, that led us to the notion that we could be happier than we actually...
Or that we figured out that we could be. More likely, what seems to have happened, to the degree that we can figure out the data, it seems pretty clear that what's happened is that our very prosperity has brought about a kind of social disconnection, a lack of community that Americans feel incredibly deeply. I mean, think about what started happening in the
1950s. This is bowling alone, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, and even beyond. I mean, think about what happened in the 50s. We used all that prosperity mostly to build ever bigger houses ever further out in the suburbs. Mathematically, we reduced the odds that we'd even run into each other in the course of a day. And, you know, as a result, Americans have about half as many close friends as they did 50 years ago. They're far less likely to eat meals with friends, family, neighbors. It turns out that that really matters to us, you know, that we evolved to be, to place at least as high a premium on those sort of social connections as on stuff. It threatens to turn into kind of farce. Did you see the story in the New York Times last week about how the sort of new trend in upscale houses in America is to build them with two master bedrooms because husbands and wives don't really want to sleep in the same bedroom anymore because one snores and the other doesn't or something like that? I mean, that level of disconnection, which is part and parcel of that affluence, it's a kind of honest mistake, perhaps, that we made, but it turns out to have been a mistake. And one of the ways to remedy it, happily, I think, is to rebuild some of these local economies that cause us to depend a little more on each other, and at the same time cause us to use a hell of a lot less fuel and spur global warming somewhat less.
Now let's continue with a section of episode 469, Lynn Gary reading about spiritual capital from Charles Eisenstein's Ascent of Humanity.
I was fortunate enough to experience childhood just before the age of video games, Nintendo, Game Boy, and the like, and was protected by idealistic parents from at least some of the damage of television. I remember spending hours in my room with my stuffed animals, rock collection, and other toys, weaving elaborate stories about them. To each I would assign a personality. Each would become a character in an imaginary world existing either solely in my own head or among siblings and playmates. Today, this creative function of imagining worlds and the characters in them has been taken over by faraway adults in television studios and software development companies, who provide children with the ready-made worlds and personalities of TV shows and video games. A capacity of the human mind has been stripped from the individual for profit's sake. And what shoddy substitutes these commercially motivated worlds are for the spontaneous creations of the child's mind. Most of them are worlds of dichotomous good and evil, where problems are solved by violence, that are devoid of nuance and detail, and that are disconnected from the rest of the world. Worse yet, they are unlike the mind of a child, finite, limited by the medium of the story. They therefore constrain the freedom of the child's mind to develop and play out various elements of the unconscious. If childhood play is practice for life, then our television raises children to be passive consumers of it. As for video games, they condition us to the mindless acquisition of meaningless rewards, points, to the destruction of generic enemies, and to accepting choices defined by remote others, the programmers of our lives. The kind of adult that results from a childhood bereft of the opportunity for spontaneous, self-directed world-making is someone who will continue to be vulnerable to stories created by others. Not only will he always be in the market for entertainment, but he will be easily manipulable by politicians and advertisers seeking to profit from the acceptance of a certain story. For they will have had no practice in creating a world for themselves. They will be content with meaningless choices contained in a box. They will be passive, determined by the forces around them, much as Newtonian massive bodies move according to the deterministic forces of physics. The economics implicit in our Newtonian worldview have conspired to create human beings whose lack of autonomy and free will confirms the mechanistic conception of dead matter moved by impersonal forces. Our cosmology has been projected onto ourselves. Meaningless choices contained in a box. Can you think of a more apt description of a video game or television? When we speak of children playing with their video games, these are not so much the object of play as they are substitutes for play. And they are merely one small aspect of the disappearance of play from our culture. Play is properly a creative activity. Give a child some blocks, and they become trucks, a city, a forest, a zoo. Put a few children together, and they create worlds of the imagination that incorporate whatever materials are available, both physical and cultural. The play worlds that children create, that together constitute the kingdom of childhood, are practiced for the creative work of the empowered adult, fashioning a good life and contributing to a beautiful world. We are meant to be creative beings, not just to live out the lives that are handed to us. Joseph Chilton Pierce has written, quote, "As a child, reality is whatever one makes of it," close quote. This is potentially true for adults as well, but unlikely if we have never experienced it as children. Unfortunately, the types of toys and activities we provide our children give them little liberty to construct their own kingdoms. Childhood has become a process of breaking the human spirit so that we are indeed content to live the lives that are offered us by the modern economy, or, if not content, unable to imagine anything else, or, if able to imagine, disbelieving of our ability to create a different life. Modern life, therefore, leaves us numb, defeated, or hopeless. How has this happened? First, in the last 50 years, the number and variety of toys available to children has proliferated into piles and piles of plastic junk, making it less necessary for them to apply their imagination and creativity to turn ordinary things of the world into toys. Joseph Chilton Pierce observes, "When today's toddler sees her mother making cookies and wants to take part, she need not resort to jar top, stick, and mud like some primitive. She probably has a complete miniature kitchen, scale model perfect with battery-operated appliances." Close quote. Imagination is less necessary. Even worse, today's toys are not passive objects of play that can only come to life in the child's mind. They are animated by electronics. The toy takes charge, and the child assumes a passive role. In most video games, a child does not create the story, but instead moves through a story that has been created for her. Ah, how like modern adult life. If there is room for exploration, as there is in the Pokemon Game Boy, it is still, unlike the real world, finite and programmed. The world is finite, and its limits have been set by someone else. The only mysteries are those that have been fabricated and doled out. I remember as a boy spending hours and hours with my globe, tracing the mountain ranges with my finger, connecting the oceans, making up stories about the different countries, comparing sizes and latitudes. Today's toy globes come complete with computer chips and voice recordings that turn the child into a passive absorber of information. Advertising and packaging for the profusion of computer-enabled devices on the market today trumpet them as educational, as if education were the acquisition of facts.